Thank you, Brother Michael. Adrian. Well, hopefully we're all refreshed and ready to go as we gather around to contemplate once again the mind of Christ in Mark. I wonder if we've ever asked the question, I wonder what Christ would have done in this situation. I wonder what Christ would have done in that situation. I wonder what Christ would have said here or there. The respectable society around him, Christ didn't always seem to do what was expected of him. He didn't always seem to follow the established conventions, did he? But time and time again, his conduct was vindicated by the outcome. So we're going to see in this study that the outcome of the Jews' thinking also shows that they were flawed. We're going to see the outworking of what they believe should be the measure of righteousness. And we're going to judge for ourselves whether that was right or not. The question was put to the Lord in Mark chapter 2 and verse 18. Why do the disciples of John and of the Pharisees fast, and thy disciples fast not? Now the Jews put a great deal of emphasis on fasting. In fact, we're told that the Jews regarded fasting as the highest form of piety, greater than the fat of lamb. They believed that fasting would render you proof against all sorts of calamities. And in fact, one great rabbi, in order to prove this truth, sat over a hot oven for 30 days and fasted. Ironically, the Jews also believed that fasting would bring the Messiah. And so we're told that in Luke chapter 18 verse 12 that the Jews fasted twice a week, namely Monday and Thursday. And their perception of Christ was that he did not fast. You know, in actual fact, they were sadly misguided in that. Christ did fast, but he didn't bother to tell anybody. And that's typical of Christ, that so often he doesn't get around to getting involved in apologetics. You know, there was a man that was actually born in Bethlehem, and yet all the nation thought he was born in Nazareth. And on that basis they rejected his claim to Messiah. But he never bothered to correct the misapprehension. As I said in the previous session, Christ was not bothered with apologetics. Rather, he was far more concerned with a manifestation of the truth, and thus commending himself, commending God's righteousness to every man's conscience. He counters then, in verse 19, with this response. Can the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. Now he was rejoining with an established Jewish convention. You see, it was widely accepted that the only people that were exempted from fast were bridal parties, the bridegroom, his groomsmen and the bride. The rabbis themselves exempted such people and their friends from all austerities, and that included fast. And then he continues straight on in verse 21 with a little parable. Skipping verse 20 there for the moment. No man also soweth a piece of new cloth and on an old garment, else the new piece that filled it up taketh away from the old, and the rent is made worse. And no man putteth new wine into old bottles, else the new wine doth burst the bottles, and the wine is spilled, and the bottles will be marred. But new wine must be put into new bottles. What did he mean by this? Well, he's actually basing this parable on something that's said in Psalm 102, among other places. Have a look at Psalm 102. Now in Psalm 102, the psalmist writes concerning the heavens and the earth. He says in verse 25, Psalm 102, Of old that hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hand. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment. As a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. Now we know that the heavens and earth as we see them, the terra firma upon which we stand, and the sky that arches over our heads, is still here. But the psalmist says that these heavens and earth will pass away. Isaiah says much the same thing concerning the heavens and the earth in chapter 61 and verse 6. But Isaiah's prophecy also begins with this statement, doesn't it? Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. And by that we know that Isaiah is actually talking to the rulers and the ruled of Jewish society. He's talking about the whole structure of the Jewish society, the Jewish commonwealth, as it then was, under the Mosaic Code. And he says concerning that, that it's going to be folded up, it's going to be rolled up, and it's going to pass away and it's going to be changed, like an old garment. And Christ is borrowing that analogy, and he's applying it to these conventions back in Mark chapter 2, you see? That's extremely clever. Now, when was the time going to come when these things were going to be rolled up? Well, the time came in AD 70, with the ending of the Jewish Commonwealth, as the Roman legions marched through Jerusalem, sweeping all the resistance aside, and they levelled the temple, so that not one stone stood upon another. They razed it to the ground and sold the Jews off into captivity to the four corners of the globe. And that was the end of the old garment. And you know what's uncanny about this is that in our own time, archaeologists have gone and they've excavated. They've found caves down by the Dead Sea where the last remnants of that Jewish commonwealth fled. The last vestiges of resistance against the Roman legions. And some of them hid away in caves. And they even found the keys to their houses, hopefully placed there, expectant that they might come again to their homes, but they were never to return. You know what they found in those caves, amongst other things? Well, look. They found leather shoes, preserved because of the dry atmosphere that's down by the Dead Sea there. They found a wineskin, and they found a fragment of a garment. I think that is so uncanny. And it's almost as if the angels have allowed those things to be preserved there as evidence of all that the Jewish Commonwealth stood for. There they are, sequestered away in this cave for 2,000 years. For archaeologists like Yigal Yadin to scale the system, to go into those caves and to find them. And there they are, the old garment and the wineskin. Evidence that what Christ said would come to pass. And it did. But what do these things symbolise? Why the garment and the wineskin? Well, the garment's what you wrap around you, isn't it? So it really represents the externals, doesn't it, of the Jewish system. Those things that are outside, those things that are seen without. And that garment would make a poor wedding garment, a shabby wedding garment indeed, would it not? On the other hand, what about the wineskin? Well, that contains the wine, didn't it, which one drank, which one took within themselves, and it represents the thinking of the old code, the old system, the old legal way of thinking, which also is outmoded with the coming of Christ. And what Christ is saying when he says, you cannot put a piece of new cloth on an old garment, he's saying, look, you can't cobble the principles of the gospel, the principles of Christ, onto the law of Moses. That would make a poor and shabby garment for the wedding feast of the future age, would it not? You can't cobble, you can't mix the new and vibrant and fresh thinking of Christ with the old and tired and sour thinking of the legal code of Moses. So you see, no man put a new wine into old bottles, else the new wine will burst the bottles and the wine will be spilled
and the bottle will be marked.
You see, this sort of bottle doesn't have the flexibility to accommodate the expansive thinking of Christ. Within law, a man is restricted within certain bounds. There's limits to law, but to the thinking of Christ, there is no limit. So if you were to put that sort of thinking into that tired old skin, of course it will slip. And I just think it's so amazing to see those things in that cave dating way back to this very time. What a staggering thing. So the garment pertains to that which is external, the behaviour, and the wine to that which was within the man, the thinking. Both change with Christ. Really, I think Ipswich Collier's got a perfect little analogy in his Principles and Progress, where right at the beginning he talks about law and principle. And he says this, he says that law is like a map. It's limited to locality and to time. It's limited by time and place. You see, if you have a map, say, of Sydney Harbour, you can't use that map to navigate into New York Harbour. You'd run aground, wouldn't you? So you see, maps are localised. They're restricted. And the law of Moses is like that. It was restricted to time, to place, and to people. Wasn't it? In fact, you could get three P's out of it. Period, people, place. No? The period of the Mosaic economy. The people of Israel. And the place, the land of Israel. And it only pertained to those things. It was only relevant in that time and place. And it wouldn't fit elsewhere. But principles, on the other hand, are like stars, aren't they? Because, you see, you can navigate by a star wherever you go. It's constant. And it's universal. And that's what a principle's like. And principles are things like mercy, justice, truth, love. And they transcend the bounds of law altogether. So laws are like maps, specific to time and person and locality. And principle is like navigating by the stars. I'm sure Brother James Stane will appreciate those ideas. Well, after that little episode, we find in verse 23 that it came to pass that he went through the cornfields on the Sabbath day, and his disciples began, as they went, to pluck the ears of corn, in accordance with the provisions of the law, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 24 and 25. Nevertheless, the Pharisees said in verse 24 to him, "Behold, why do they on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful?" Why do they on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful? And you know, the Jews laid enormous stress on Sabbath keeping. It was considered to be supremely important in the Jewish way of life. And to this very day it is, in fact. They have some extraordinary provisions in Jewish life concerning the Sabbath, even in modern times. For instance, in Edison records these things, that the Pharisees laid enormous stress on Sabbath keeping, the rabbis evolving minute and burdensome laws which it was a capital crime to breach. They amplified the law, the single law, into 39 fathers and their so-called descendants. So there were main categories, 39 main categories, and then underneath them was this tree of subcategories. So hence, you know, that it was forbidden to take a chair and to drag it across the floor, because you see, there might be dirt on the floor, and as you drag the leg of the chair, it would plough the dirt. So you were ploughing, see? You wouldn't look in a mirror, because you might be tempted to pluck a grey hair, and that would be, yes, at reaping. They go on to say you shouldn't wear false teeth on the Sabbath day, sorry folks, or a gold inlay, or a wig. A tailor shouldn't carry a needle, because that, of course, was his tool of trade, any more than a scribe should carry a pen, because that was his tool of trade. They are both bearing a burden. Cutting nails or hair was punishable by death, if done in the ordinary way. And on the other hand, it was forbidden to mourn. Even the poor should eat well and dress well. The fires, and goodness, I've made a spelling mistake there, the fires of Gehenna were said to shut down on the Sabbath day. marvellous. Even the devil supposedly was subject to this particular law, this one law. An interesting little twist is that you could wear a dressing on a wound to prevent it from becoming worse, but not to heal it, because that doesn't work. And you know, even today, if you go to some places, some Jewish buildings have lifts which automatically run up and down all day on the Sabbath, and you just hop in and you don't press the button, because you'd be doing work to push the button to make the lift go up and down. And some farmers go to the extent of continuing to plough on the Sabbath day, because it's very necessary to get that done, but they put a little canopy over the top of the tractor, so they're actually sitting in a little moving house. That's fine. Can you see the sort of mindset that this is developing, that the law develops? You make a law, you put a law there, and sure as fate, someone's going to look for a loophole in it. And that's the perversity of the human mind, which we all possess, isn't it? Now, this expression, that which is not lawful, is it lawful, is something that you find on the lips of the Judaizers, on the lips of the Pharisees from time to time. It crops up again in Mark chapter 10. I want to just make a brief foray across to Mark chapter 10. We're not going to deal with that later on because we don't have time, but I'd just like you to see how that this expression is on the lips of the Pharisees more than once. Look at this in Mark chapter 10 verse 2. We find this again. And this is quite instructive to see how Christ deals with this. The Pharisees came to him and asked him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife? Simply. Alright, so they asked the question, is it lawful to do this? Later on, we find a young man rushes up to him, a young lawyer. In verse 17, when he was gone forth in the way, there came one running and kneeled to him and asked him, good master, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life? So the Lord leaves these Pharisees and he walks off down the road. You can imagine him trudging off in the dust. And the next minute, the disciples turn and they can see a little puff of smoke in the distance. And as this puff of smoke grows larger, they discern a man in the middle of this. And there's this young lawyer. He's running flat out after Christ to catch him, because he had another question for him. Now let's leave. He sits or halts at the Lord's feet. And we can imagine puffing and saying, good master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Now what we've got here is actually two questions. We're not supposed to actually analyse thoroughly how this is all dealt with here and now, but I think that the overview that we take of this will actually be quite instructive. We've got two questions here, and what Christ does is he shows that in both cases there is really something fundamentally wrong with the thinking you ask these questions. And we need to consider the whole context of the lead-in from Mark chapter 9 concerning salt, having salt in ourselves, and the following verses in Mark chapter 10, because it's all helpful. I'll summarise it for you to show you the way that Christ views these things. Call this transparency minima and maxima. Alright? In Mark chapter 10, Christ is asked two questions. And he shows in both cases that there is something fundamentally wrong with the thinking of the person to even ask such a question. The Pharisees ask, is it lawful to do this or that? In effect, they're saying, how much can I legally get away with and still get eternal life? That's pretty cynical, isn't it? But that was their view of God. You think God would respond to a person like that? In other words, they're saying, what is the minimum we have to do to get into the kingdom? You know, the do you have to? Do you have to wear a white shirt if you're going to give a lecture? Do you have to have your hair cut above your ears? You know, the do you have to question. They're saying, you draw me a line and I'll stand on it. And you can't get me, I'm going to be in the kingdom. You draw the line, I'm standing on the line, I have to be in the kingdom. That's the mentality of this sort of a question, isn't it? On the other hand, the young lawyer says, what must I do to inherit eternal life. And I think he is saying, well, what is the maximum requirement to get into the kingdom? What's the upper limit on righteousness? And they both have a problem. Both are setting limits on righteousness. And what Christ does is he helps them analyse their thinking and attitude towards God. And that's why I think you find Christ says to the Pharisees, says, well, what does Moses say? And of course their mind goes straight to the law. Whereas I think Christ is saying, go straight to Genesis. What does Moses say in Genesis about a man putting away his wife? What does he say about in Genesis about Adam and Eve being put together as man and wife? Why don't you strive for the higher? Strive for the ideal. You're setting limits on righteousness. Both the Pharisee, who said, what's the minimum? Where's the line? And the young lawyer, who says, well, you know, where's the upper limit on righteousness? How much do you have to do to fill up the measure of righteousness so I can say, well, I've done it. I've done enough. I'm going to be in the kingdom. Thank you, God. That's legalism, isn't it? And it's the reward then is reckoned of debt and not of grace. And that's why Christ uses the little child to illustrate the principle. The solution is illustrated in the little child. He's spoken about children at the end of Mark chapter 9. He talks about offending the little ones. He talks about in Mark chapter 9 having salt within ourselves. And the solution comes is illustrated well with these children. What is it about children that can help the disciples? Well, children are simple, they're sincere and unsophisticated and trusted. And it's that salt of sincerity that's a cure to the legal cynicism, cynical legalism, I should say, of the Pharisees. Because the cynical legalism of the Pharisees says, well, you draw the line and I'll stand on it. The child says, how much more can I do to please you? The sincere, childlike simplicity of a child transcends that, doesn't it? And for the young lawyer, trusting God to receive the kingdom, and that's what he says, doesn't he? He says, except you receive the kingdom, in verse 15, as a little child, you will not enter therein. You've got to receive the kingdom, you can't earn it. And that receiving of the kingdom as an unearned gift is the answer to pride in adult achievement, as seen in the young lawyer. So when the Pharisees ask the question, are you doing that which is not lawful? And is it lawful to do this or is it lawful to do that? Christ says, sorry, you know, you're reading on a completely wrong basis. We're dealing in grace here, not law. We've transcended law. We can't force that into the old wineskin. It just won't fit. It'll burst. So back in Mark chapter 2 now. We find the Christ response to the Jews' challenge. The Jews went to extraordinary lengths to keep the Sabbath, as we've seen, but they missed it, completely missed the spirit of it. And now, in verse 25, Christ rejoins them, in verse 25 of chapter 2 of Mark, have ye never read what David did when he had need and was in hunger, he and they that were with him? And this is a little insight into the way the man worked, you see, because this have ye never expression was a classic expression of the rabbis when they got up in the synagogue and taught, and I'd love to tell you about how they conducted their meetings. It's amazing. The rabbis would get up and they would talk in this very high-handed tone, and they'd say, well, have you never read this, and have you never read that? And in a way, they would really put down their audience. So Christ picks up their own expression and says, well, have you never read what David did? But the thing is, although, putting aside Christ's irony, mimicking the language of the scribes, I ask the question, why did he cite what David did? How, in verse 26, he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, and did eat the showbread, which is not lawful to eat. Again, a little bit of an ironic dig there in Christ, but for the priests, and gave also to them that were with him. Why is Christ citing that? Did Christ need to make an appeal to what David did to vindicate what he would do? Do you think that really is legitimate? Or is there something more to it? Well, let's wait and see just what emerges. Because I think there's a little bit more to it. I find it hard to believe that David would make recourse to, Christ would make recourse to what David did in order to justify his action. After all, he's the Son of God. Does he need to rely on a precedent set by a king of Israel who was less than perfect? I think there's more in it. I think that would hardly be the case. And you'll notice that Christ is careful to point out that it was David and they that were with him. Just remember that Christ is not recorded having eaten on that occasion. The disciples were evidently very hungry. And no doubt Christ was too, but he was shameless. So no one could actually accuse him of breaking the law after all, if they did want to get technical. But he makes this one point that David did these things when he had need and wasn't hungered. It was a matter of need. They're the operative words. And Christ is really asking the question, should a man starve in order to keep the Sabbath? He's got a conflict there, hasn't he? And he's also throwing that question at them to deal with at the same time. So he wraps it up in verse 27 by saying, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. But the "and" is not actually there. It's an "as," what they call an "as" invention. It's a classic literary form of Mark. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. That's the grunt. And in doing so, he actually really alludes to the words of the rabbis themselves, because the rabbis had been known to say themselves, the Sabbath is handed over to you and not you to the Sabbath. That was actually one of the sayings of the rabbis in their own ancient writing. So he really hoisted them on their own petard a little with that one. Now, in chapter 3, verse 1, the story is really continuing, and that's why we began it where we did in chapter 2. Because once again, in chapter 3, verse 1, he enters again into the synagogue. Now, just a little word again. Why put that in there? Because Mark's telling us this is a pattern. You see? He could have just said, he entered into the synagogue. No, he entered again into the synagogue. So, okay, we're going to start another cycle of synagogue house. Aren't we? He entered again into the synagogue. And again we're going to see some sort of interaction. We can expect that. Yes? And there was a man there which had a withered hand. Oh. Now, what do we make of that? Well, without getting too profound about it, we can say this much. If you've got a withered hand, what can you do with it? You can't pick too much up, can you? You can't work, not even on the Sabbath day, if you wanted to. And that really, before you go any further, is a very apt description of the Jews themselves. Harrow, somewhat paralysed by law, weren't they? It's interesting. There's a man with a withered hand, and a hand, if it stands for anything, must stand for work. Now here's a man that was deprived of the power of work altogether. He's totally paralyzed. He can't work at all, Sabbath or no Sabbath. And really, under the law, we could say the same to the Jews, that they were really restricting themselves from fulfilling the whole righteousness of God, from doing the true work of God. And while he was in the synagogue, they knew of this man. Verse 2, they watched him, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. They watched to see whether he would heal this man on the Sabbath day of this terrible affliction, this paralysis. But, right, okay, let's see what he does here. We know we've got this chap in the synagogue and he's got this withered hand. We'll set him up and see what he does. Hey? That they might accuse him. And the Greek word, in this case, I found it quite instructive, but The Greek word here is kategori. Now, I don't know, but that sounds horribly similar to our word category or categorize, isn't it? They wanted to put Christ in a box, and that's typical, isn't it, of the legal way of thinking. Okay, now this person belongs in the X box. Okay, we've got him here. We understand where he's coming from. He belongs in that box. Whereas we are in this box. We belong to the Y party, you see? So we'll get him and we'll be able to give him a box and put a label on him. And then we'll know exactly where he stands and we can deal with him then. Because you see, that's the trouble with Christ. They kept trying to put him in a box and he'd pop out of that box. And he didn't seem to fit in that box and he didn't seem to fit in that box. There was a contradiction to them. They were frustrated by that. If they could get him, nail him down on something, then they could put him in a box. They could categorize him. And they thought that they had judged Christ. Instead, he gives them the chance to judge themselves. So they wanted to watch to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath day. Now, this is also instructive. They wanted to see whether he would do something or not do something on the Sabbath day. So you see, their idea of righteousness was that it was based on what a man did not do on the Sabbath day. If you did not heal on the Sabbath day, then you were righteous. And they were quite content to actually park themselves in a chair for the duration of the Sabbath day, fold their arms, and when time was up, hop out of the chair and say, well, I haven't sinned, so therefore I must have been righteous. Because I did not work on the Sabbath day, I did not do any thing that I should not have done, I didn't heal or whatever it might have been, and therefore I'm righteous. So rather pessimistic view of righteousness, I might venture to say. And in this style, very much like the man with the withered hand. They may never have done any evil on the Sabbath day, but nor did they do any good. It's not God's definition of righteousness. The righteousness of God is a positive righteousness. It's a positive attribute based on what God actively does. It's like goodness, isn't it? It's seen in positive action, not in negative in action. And you notice I alluded to that even in child training, the discipline of the child is not giving a kid a smack in the ear when they annoy you and then not bothering to reward them or to encourage them or to guide them in other manners. Discipline is a complete thing, and it happens to be a positive thing as well as a negative thing. If you simply smack the child when they disturb you, you send out a clear signal to that child that you don't care about them. So I'll pick it up like that. But true child training is positive and praise. It finds things to do, it sets boundaries, it sets goals and ideas for the child to live up to, and above all other things, it leads the way. And you notice that came out in the first session. So these sort of things are positive. They are, if you forgive the word, a proactive word. They are proactive things as opposed to reactive. The Jews' idea of righteousness was a reactive sort of righteousness. It was a negative in action. But true righteousness and true act, true goodness is proactive, not passive. Now, I want to make a little brief excursion across to Matthew to illustrate this, because Matthew is absolutely fantastic on this. Matthew 5. Look at Matthew 5 verse 17. Christ comes to the Jews and he says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And the word destroyed here, by the way, is kathluo. Completely, thoroughly destroyed. I've not come to thoroughly destroy the prophets, but to fulfill them. Verse 19. Whosoever shall therefore break one of these least commandments, and he's talking about his, and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. And whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now again, you've got this word great. And here's a bit of a literary effect that Christ is employing here. He says, I haven't come to completely destroy the law. No, I've come to complete it, to fill it up. But whosoever shall break, and it's not Catholic, it's simply luo, whosoever shall relax the least of my principles will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. You see? And so he goes on, you take verse 27 and 28. First of all, before we do that, you'll notice he says there, for in verse 20, for I say unto you, just back over page 20 there, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. Now that must have astounded his hearers, because the scribes and Pharisees were the moral paragons of Jewish society. Everybody looked at them and they were perfect. They lived immaculate life. And when Christ said, look, except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you won't enter the kingdom of heaven in any case. They were absolutely flabbergasted. Well, then how can you be such? Well, what are you talking about? I think it's very well illustrated by the positive righteousness that he asserts in chapter 5, verse 27, over the page then. For instance, ye have heard, and this is the formula, isn't it, the employer, ye have heard that I say unto you, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now what he's saying here is, look, the only bar to sin in this illustration is lack of opportunity. If you say, look, the law says you should not commit adultery, but then you harbour such a desire in your heart, then the only bar to sin in that situation is lack of opportunity. And that really amounts to doing good by accident, doesn't it? That's righteousness by accident. Righteousness by good luck. And you're running a mighty great risk in a matter like that, aren't you? If you can see that line of thinking. Again, a passive righteousness. And so, I think there's a great line that cropped up in the 18th century concerning such a matter. This is the way we could summarise it. He said, look, your righteousness has got to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, otherwise in no case you're going to enter the kingdom. Verse 27 and 28 illustrate to us the point that if we entertain a thought, then Christ says the only bar to sin in that situation is simply lack of opportunity, which amounts to righteousness by accident. And that's not a terribly sort of positive sort of right. And so one writer sums things up this way. It is not that you should do wrong by design, but that you should never do right by mistake. It is not that you do wrong by design. That's not the issue, Christ is saying. But that you should never do right by mistake. Righteousness is positive. There is true righteousness is active and positive, not passive and negative. So we have the example of the Father himself in verse 45 of Matthew 5, haven't we? He says in verse 44, but I say unto you, love your enemies, positive. Bless them that hate you, positive. Pray for them that which despitefully use you and persecute you, positive. That ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sendeth his rain on the just and the unjust. They're positive words. God doesn't sit back and just let the rain happen, brethren and sisters. God doesn't just passively sit back and let the sun go moto perpetua around the earth, or the earth turn, in order that the sun might rise. God actually makes his sun to rise every morning. He actively does that. For the 6,000 years that this world has been in existence the way it is, God has been making that happen every morning. So that it breaks and it shines over Sinjara here, and it shines on the prison down the road, if there's one. And it doesn't selectively shine. You don't find a big cloud patch over the prison, and sunshine on Sinjara. Or likewise, that the rain falls on the farms of the righteous, but not on the farms of the wicked. Unless God actively states that he will do so, in which case it proves the miracle, doesn't it? Because miracles are not extraordinary acts. They are extraordinary acts that God has predicted will happen. So, God's righteousness is positive and active, not passive and negative. He sends his rain, he makes his sun to shine. And the wrap up of it is in verse 48. The sword of righteousness that Christ speaks is this, in verse 48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. You see, Christ strives for nothing less than heaven's perfection. Nothing less is acceptable. And that's why it's wrong to say, well, look, just show me the line. Okay, where does the law end? Look, you tell human nature what the law is, what the rule is, and sure as fate, they'll find the loophole. But love says, what more can I do to please? What more can I do to please? Be perfect then, says the Lord Jesus Christ. Now let's return back to Mark chapter 3 and see what Christ does with this situation. Mark chapter 3 then, he knew what was happening. He knew he'd been set up. And verse 3 of Mark 3, he says to the man with the withered hand, and notice of course the fact he's aware that there's a man with a withered hand to begin with. So he's wise in the situation. He knows there's a man in that audience who's got a withered hand. And you think that that in itself would prove to the Jews that this man was extraordinary. He says to the man with a withered hand, stand forth. And you can imagine in an audience like this, every eye is on this poor man. He says, right, you, out here. Come forth in the midst, into the centre of the room. And he sets that man in the centre of the room. So every eye is focused on that man. Becomes the centre of attention. And he's going to be there for an illustration of the principle that Christ now wants to bring forth to them. And having the man then set before them, before their eyes, he then starts his questions to them in verse 4. He says unto them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day or to do evil? And he takes up their own words. Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day or to do evil? Answer me. To save life or to kill? Answer me. But they held their peace. They were cowards all. They were ready to accuse him, but they wouldn't answer a simple question. So he borrows their own words. For the Jews, the only question was, is it lawful to work or not to work? But Christ takes it further. Look what he does with it. Oh, that's pretty confusing, isn't it? Let's discuss that a bit. Christ asks the question, is it lawful to do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill? In other words, what he is saying is, if you're not doing good, then you must be doing evil. If you're not saving life, then you're killing. Now that might seem a rather large leap, but that must be what he's saying. If you're not doing good, then you must be doing evil. It's not sufficient to sit yourself in that chair, fold your arms for the duration of the Sabbath day and say, well, I haven't sinned. You have. Because you haven't done positive good. The Jews thought that if they did nothing on the Sabbath day, then they couldn't be sinning. But Christ is saying, there is no such thing as passive good. There is no such thing as passive good. All good is active. And he just simply says, well, you tell me, is it lawful to do good or evil? What are you going to do on the Sabbath day? You can't be passive.
You can't be sitting there and saying, well, I'm not doing good and I'm not doing evil. You see? You must be doing one or the other. You can't have a moral vacuum. You're either doing good or you're doing evil. Answer me. Is it lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath day? What are you going to do? Here's a man with a wicked hand. You know, let him stand there. Well, if I've got the power to help him, should I help him? Argumentum ad hominem, the Brother Thomas would say, isn't it? It's an argument beyond men. So they kept their peace. They couldn't say a word. And that very moment they gave the verdict on themselves. And then, verse 5, in a characteristic gesture, when he had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their heart. This is typical of the Lord. This is one of the little, and I'll tell this one in, Terry Blepo, round about. And you can imagine, in a synagogue, there would have been the opportunity to look right round the room. And we can imagine his blazing eyes roving right round every face. He made every person in that room accountable for what he was about to do. He put the proposition to them. Not one stood up and answered. And he was saying, you're all answerable. Isn't he? And that's a little characteristic of the Lord, that he would spin about on his foot and he would look right around the room like that and take every face in. He could look every person right down in the eye, couldn't he? Without the least fear. Having done that, we're told that he did it in anger. A rare moment of anger, of truly justified anger, and it'd be a study in its own right to investigate when it is truly justified to be angry. But he was angry and grieved for the hardness of their hearts. And the Greek actually means to fuse the bones. You know, it's the blindness that happened in part that's happened to Israel. The sclerocardia, a hardening of the heart. Coming from a word to mean the fusing of bones, and you'll see in the margin it says all blindness, Romans 11:25. This is the blindness that Paul was talking about in Romans 11. Having done that, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it forth, and it was whole. It was whole, as the other is not there in the Greek. He stretched forth his hand and it was whole. As if it was already whole. No one had seen it happen. There it was, complete. And with that, his argument was fulfilled. He proved that true righteousness is about active goodness. Being proactive, not passive and negative. The interesting thing is that expression to stretch out his hand is an expression which is often used, isn't it, in the Hebrew scriptures to denote prayer. He stretched forth his hand as if in the act of prayer. He was now able to approach the Father in a way he'd never had before. And in the very action, the man, it seems, was restored in the act of stretching forth the hand in the attitude of prayer. Reminds us of Jeroboam, doesn't it, who stretched forth his hand to tell them to take the prophet, and it was withered up. And here's another man who stretches forth his hand as in the attitude of prayer, and it's healed. Well, what is the true spirit of the Sabbath? Well, there is a benchmark passage in Scripture that tells us what the true spirit of the Sabbath is. Let's just summarise the spirit of the Sabbath and see what comes out of it. In Genesis 2, the Sabbath day was blessed and sanctified as Yahweh ceased and contemplated all his creation. And Brother Thomas tells us in Helpless Israel that a day is blessed because of what will be imparted to those that keep it. Those that keep the spirit of it. And so the Sabbath was enjoined upon Israel in Exodus 20, verse 8. And they were told there, when you look at Exodus 20, to cease from all their work. And that's the operative word that the Jews overlooked. Because we find in Exodus chapter 31, verse 1, that Israel is commended to the work of the tabernacle, whilst being reminded at the same time of the Sabbath law.
It's Isaiah 58 that is really the benchmark chapter, isn't it, on the Sabbath. Because there in Isaiah 58 we're told that the spirit of the Sabbath is a time to serve others and to serve God. Let's have a look at Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58 is about fasts, but we've seen that Sabbath keeping belongs to the same category as the fasts that have already been addressed earlier on in Mark 2. Verse 3 of Isaiah 58, the Jews protested to God, "Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge?" See, it was all negative. "We've done these things, and you're not taking any notice." He says, "I'll tell you why. Behold, in the day of your fast ye find pleasure, and exact all your labours. Behold, ye fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. Ye shall not fast as ye do this day, to make your voice to be heard on high. Is it such a fast as that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush, and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast and an acceptable day to Yahweh?" See, it's all negative. "We haven't done this and we haven't done that, and we've suffered so much. We went without food. So you must be pleased." God says, "No. You've totally got it wrong. My righteousness is a positive righteousness." Isaiah 58, verse 6. "Is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke." They're positive things, aren't they? Undo heavy burdens. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. Deal thy bread to the hungry. And bring the poor that are cast out to thy house. When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thy own flesh. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of Yahweh shall be thy reward. This is positive righteousness, brethren and sisters and young people. This is what Isaiah is about. Verse 13. "If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of Yahweh, honourable, and shalt honour him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words, then shalt thou delight thyself in Yahweh, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth, and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of Yahweh hath spoken it." There's the spirit of the Sabbath. And doesn't that illustrate to us clearly how that righteousness is active, not passive? The Sabbath and fasts are not to burden a person down, to bow their head down like a bulrush, to afflict themselves and to clothe in sackcloth and ashes, but to do good to others. Now look at Isaiah 59, verse 1. These things apply to Yahweh. Yahweh is the model. Isaiah 59, verse 1. "Behold, Yahweh's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy, that it cannot hear." Isn't that uncanny? The Lord was to heal a man with a withered hand in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. Because he said, "I'm healing that man so that he can work on the Sabbath day, so that he can do righteousness on the Sabbath day, so he can stretch forth his hand in prayer. I work on the Sabbath day." And Isaiah 59 verse 1, "My Father works on the Sabbath day, because his hand's outstretched to forgive your iniquities." Isaiah 59 verse 2, "But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear." The only barrier to God's forgiveness is your intransigence. His hand is stretched out, Sabbath or not, every day to forgive you. So how much more should not this man's hand be stretched forth on the Sabbath day? What an amazing twist there is in that whole story. But there's more to come. What happened after this back in Mark chapter 3? What was the Jews' reaction? And here's the clincher in this whole story. Mark chapter 3 and verse 6. And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. The Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel. Aha! So here we've got the Pharisees acting spontaneously, immediately. Here's their spontaneous reaction to Christ. Just as the Father had spontaneously burst forth with those words of commendation and encouragement to his son, now the Pharisees go forth and spontaneously take counsel in hate and in bitterness. And look who they take counsel with. The Diablo actually says that they not took counsel but gave counsel. They were the initiators in this. And they gave counsel with none other than the Herodians. The Herodians, supporters of Herod the Edomite, the Idumean, of whom it was said that he came to the throne like a fox, ruled like a tiger and died like a dog. A man who was cruel, unscrupulous, brutal, even to his flesh and blood. Obsessed and paranoid about power. Possessed with fear of plots against him. So much so that he'd kill his own sons rather than have them take the throne from him. On the merest suspicion, killed wife after wife and lived haunted by their spectres. This was the man and his party with whom they took counsel. It's been truly said by John Dryden, the poet, youth, beauty, graceful actions seldom fail. The common interest always will prevail. And so it was in this instance. That common interest united them with the most unscrupulous and brutal and immoral of all men at that time. But look who Herod was. What nationality was he? An Idumean. And the Idumeans were none other than the Edomites. And therein lies the final judgment of the Jews. You see what Christ has done? He cited the instance of David. How that he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the priest and partook of the holy bread. Who saw them on that day? Doeg the Edomite. And when Saul later was to harangue his men and say, none of you was sorry for me and none of you take pity on me and showeth me that my sons made a league with this David, the son of Jesse, who came forth and told tales on David. Doeg, the Edomite, the Edomite. And Saul took counsel with Doeg the Edomite to slay the priest of Yahweh, the high priest. And 80 people, women and children, were slaughtered on that day. Just like Herod had slaughtered the babies of Bethlehem on the mere suspicion that his throne might be taken from him. Just like Doeg of old, ruthless, cruel, unscrupulous and godless. And they took counsel with that man. Isn't that staggering? They found common cause with this paranoid ruler to destroy one whose only sin was to do good. But Christ is to have the last word. Verse 7, but Jesus withdrew himself, and that theme, by the way, that expression, I should say, is a theme. You'll see it there in verse 45 on chapter 1 there, just at the same page, if you've still got it open. He was without in desert places. It's the word from which we get hermit, actually, this desert places.
And again, it's a little pattern of behaviour of the Lord. He goes into synagogues, he goes into desert places, the solitary places, he goes into the house. But Jesus withdrew himself with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed him and from Judea. So forth he goes as a king, and he leads triumphant in his train people from Galilee and from Judea and from Jerusalem and from Idumea and beyond Jordan. And they about Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude, when they had heard what great things he did, and came unto him. Herod might have been paranoid about people taking his power from him, but there was nothing he could do about it. This man had taken subjects from his own territory, from Idumea, and he led captivity captive. Now, don't use that expression lightly, because the whole rest of this chapter is about Psalm 68. There on the page, just had a mental blank, but it's as clear as anything in my mind. Psalm 68. That God arise, and that his enemies be scattered. He's ascended on high, let captivity captive go, gives to men. You read the rest of this. You know what he does next? Verse 13. He goes up into a high mountain. He ordains 12. He gives them power to heal sicknesses. And he goes into a house. And he talks about binding the strong man that he might spoil his house. He'd done it. He'd bound Herod without Herod even knowing, and he'd spoiled his house. And led in his train people from all over the place, including Idumea. The irony of this is just amazing. It's just rich, isn't it, with irony? So he, from the very heartland of the enemy's territory, he led captivity captive and bound the strong man, Herod. So in conclusion, we've seen that Christ has shown the way to true righteousness. That true righteousness is active, not passive. It's seen in the power of positive good, not negative restriction, and in constantly seeking the higher good in the battle against sin. And if we constantly seek the higher good, then the fight against those negative things that assail us virtually takes care of itself.